We begin with breaking news out of Gambia. The Electoral Commission there has confirmed that opposition candidate Adama Barrow has won the presidential election, effectively bringing an end to current President Yahya Jammeh's 22-year rule.
Celebration of Jammeh's defeat continue throughout the country.
I'm so happy for the Gambians because we don't have no war, we don't have no violence. The election go peaceful.
At the end of 2016, while all eyes were on the US presidential election, there was another election in the Gambia, the smallest nation in West Africa. It didn't receive the same attention in the Western media, but the result sent shockwaves across the African continent. Hello, I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on RN and via your ABC radio app. The Gambian presidential election unseated President Yahya Jammeh, who had ruled the Gambia since a coup in 1994. So why was this election so important in Africa? Let's start by trying to understand the Gambia, its geography and its unique position in West Africa. Abdoulaye Sen is Professor of Global Economics and Politics at Miami University and the author of The Paradox of the Third Wave, Democratization in Africa.
Gambia is a small country in West Africa, the smallest actually. And it is surrounded on all sides except on the Atlantic coast by Senegal, which is a much larger country of about 14 million. Gambia has a population of 1.8 million. The geographic location of the country is very odd. It had to do with disputes during the colonial period between the French and the English. The British were much more interested in the river, which is navigable for approximately 300 miles. What ended up was that the country was carved out around the river, 15 miles the widest point, and then the rest of it went to the French in the Treaty of Versailles.
So in essence, the Gambia at its widest point is only 15 miles.
Yes, about 15 miles, yes. It's really a very odd location because it sticks out like a tongue in the middle of Senegal. In other words, you have to cross the Gambia River to go to the southern part of Senegal. So Gambia really splits Senegal almost in half.
And what's the population of Gambia and what's the kind of ethnic makeup?
Gambia is a multi-ethnic country. Despite its size of 4,000 square miles and a population of 1.8 million, we have roughly 9 to 10 main ethnic groups constituted by the Fulani, the Mandinka, the Sarahule, the Aku, who are offsprings or liberated slaves. We have the Sarahule, the Jola, and really quite a number of other much smaller ethnic groups.
The history of the Gambia is closely tied to the history of the Gambian River. Aisha Dabu is a Gambian Senegalese journalist and activist. She spoke to me from Gambia on a very shaky Skype line.
If you look at the Gambia River, it takes its source from Guinea. So it has been very important in the trade because they would use the ships just to go up and down the river. And then they had access to the Atlantic Ocean. Another thing is the Gambia actually was a transit point for slaves as well. Gambia and Senegal, at least 3 million slaves left those rivers to go to the Americas.
The Gambia was a major hub for the slave trade. The Europeans, of course, having arrived there in the early 1400s, slavery in earnest didn't occur, but it is reported a few Gambians and Africans were taken over to Portugal. When the slave trade began in earnest, it became a hub for the transit of captured enslaved Africans to Europe, but more importantly to the Caribbean and then to colonial America.
And has that had a lasting effect on Gambia at all, the sort of its involvement in the slave trade?
It did, and I believe it continues to do. Perhaps the effects are less visible today. But clearly, the transport of significant numbers of individuals in some ways depopulated the region It took skills that otherwise would have helped develop the region, and some cultural elements also died in the process.
The Gambia and the Gambia River became a British colony, while neighbouring Senegal fell under the influence of the French. Nicholas Holton is an assistant professor of global affairs at George Mason University and focuses on the Gambia.
The British arrived in force in the early 1800s. There were minor British presences along the Gambia River before them, but you basically can speak of the sort of beginning of British significant colonialism in the Gambia in 1816. And I guess I would say that the British colonial presence was one of relative neglect. The Gambia was never a sort of crown jewel in the British Empire. It was not India, it was not Nigeria, it was not Kenya. It was one that had a fairly minimal economic base. Gambia doesn't really have any super valuable natural resources to this day. And it was one with a small British population. You did not have any kind of a settler colonialism of the sort that you would see, say, for example, in Kenya and Tanzania. So the Gambia was a colony, and the British legacy, you still see that in a lot of different things, not least of which being the language, the form of the legal system and so forth. But in terms of if you would count sort of British troops or administrators on the ground in the Gambia would be a relatively small number. There was not a significant entity in terms of the British Empire. I think it was kind of an afterthought in some ways. There were even discussions, and I can't exactly remember when, I believe it was in the late 1800s, of the British basically trading the Gambia territory to the French, but those negotiations fell through in no small part due to protests by Gambians, because they would prefer to be colonized by the British than the French.
The Gambia gained its independence in February 1965.
Bathurst put all thoughts aside except the imminent independence of Gambia.
Independence came without much strife. It was a negotiated settlement. Unlike Kenya, unlike Algeria, Gambia really didn't engage in any form of civil strife or any kind of violence to gain independence.
And was there any discussion at independence about how the Gambia would cope? Because clearly, as you said, it's a very small country with a very particular kind of geography. And in essence, if you look at it, it probably makes more sense to be part of Senegal rather than an independent nation. So I'm wondering, was there discussion at the time of independence about how the Gambia could cope and its place in West Africa?
That was a major discussion prior to independence. In fact, the British encouraged Gambia and Gambian politicians at the time enter into some form of confederation, some integration scheme. The United Nations also conducted a major study looking into the feasibility of such a scheme, and they felt that it might have been the best thing to do for Gambia to integrate into Senegal with protocols and protections of its traditions and so forth and so on. Mind you, Gambia and Senegal are pretty much the same ethnic group, same religion, but with the euphoria surrounding independence in the 1960s, most countries gaining independence, including Gambia, wanted to some degree protect their newly won independence.
You're with Rear Vision on RN and via your ABC radio app. I'm Annabelle Quince, and we're tracing the history of the smallest nation in West Africa, the Gambia. Dorda, known as David Jawawa, led the People's Progressive Party, or PPP. The PPP ruled the Gambia for the first 22 years, and David Jawawa served first as Prime Minister and then as President.
The first government, or actually really the only government between 1965 prior to the coup in 1994, the one led by Jawara, was, I guess you would kind of think of it as a fairly kind of liberal government in the sense that they had elections that were deemed free and fair. There was a respect for the rule of law and so forth. There were attempts to develop the country within sort of the confines that they kind of were operating in. Those attempts were quite modest. The first government never built a university. The first government did not build a television station. The first government did not build enough schools and so forth. So development was definitely kind of limping along during the first government.
When people refer to Jawara, people say Dauda Keraba. Keraba means in Mandinka, peace. huge peace. He was a peaceful man. And at one point he wanted to leave, but his party and people that surrounded him said that they don't want him to leave because they don't believe that they will, the country will be able to survive after he leaves. But the downside of that first regime was the fact that there were not many roads. And when there were, you had all these potholes on the roads. So the country was really, really underdeveloped. It was difficult to have electricity. And when you had it, actually, you had power cuts. It was difficult to have access to water because the capital is swampy in some areas. You had many mosquitoes and the drainage system wasn't good. And the Gambia only had high schools, didn't have a university. So you had all these things, that basic things that people would need and that were not right.
The Gambia had a reputation for peace and stability. In fact, in the time that Sadao Jawara was in power until he was overthrown in 1994, Gambia was really one of four countries that had a viable democracy, a functioning democracy. Sadao actually was very successful in putting in place an open capitalist economy, or at least seeking to do that. In fact, Gambia reached its best economic growth record in the first years of independence from 1965 to 1975.
I think the first thing to point out is that, you know, there's democracy and there's democracy. So even though if you sort of have a checklist idea of democracy and institutions, the Gambia would kind of pass that, the ruling party of the Gambia was pretty dominant. And some historians of this period would argue that they basically kind of entrenched themselves as a de facto, almost a one-party state with the trappings of democracy. One prominent historian has referred to it as a liberal cartel. So you had a sense of the political space not being quite as open as the kind of institutional, on the face of it, composition of the country would suggest. And then you also had the fact that the economy was really not doing well. It was really the doldrums. So you had a situation where you had a government that people were kind of tired of. It wasn't that it was illegitimate, and it wasn't that people despised it or that it was oppressive. People were more like, well, it's not really working. That, of course, made all the worse by this worsening in the economy, so that when Yahya Jammeh and his co-conspirators took power in 94, there was really no resistance to speak of at all. It was a bloodless coup.
Fellow Gambians, this country has been taken over by the Gambia Armed Forces.
That's right, that was the coup d'etat that changed history.
Paolo Gaibadzi is an anthropologist and research fellow at the Center for Modern Orient, known as the ZMO in Berlin.
It was led by Lieutenant Yahya Jammeh, who was to become then the future president of the Gambia. And the coup was actually bloodless. At the time, the army was very tiny, and they managed to actually unseat Jawara, who then fled and went into exile. Why did it happen? Well, as I said, it was more by chance than by plan. But there were at least grievances in the population, which were no longer so satisfied with the PPP regime. Of course, Jawara was still seen as a father figure, as a hero of the independence, but his legitimacy, as well as that of the party, was being really threatened by a rampant corruption among politicians, as well as austerity measures in the 1980s. Structural reforms also caused a lot of unemployment and hardship for Gambians. The agricultural sector was also stagnant, partly because of mismanagement. And youth were the major victims of these transitions. They were particularly affected. And as they saw these four soldiers came to power, they identified with them. Jammeh at the time was only 29 years old, and he, and as well as the other fellows, were of humble origins. So they reflected more or less the social situation of many of the Gambian youth, who then mobilized behind the new military junta, and the junta mobilized them in turn. And this is how, in 1996, the junta managed to convert itself into a civilian party and win the election.
Paradoxically, there was a lot of euphoria amongst the larger population, even amongst the elite to some degree, because many had felt that Sadao could not be dislodged through free and fair elections. And even though he did hold, for the most part, free and fair elections with some irregularities, many still felt that given the stronghold he and the PPP, that's the major party, held, that it was impossible to defeat him. Now, this sentiment became really quite widespread and in turn became the justification partly to dislodge him. So that was euphoria, but this euphoria very quickly dissipated because the new regime, military regime, became increasingly repressive to the degree that people were wishing Saadat had still been in power.
Although the military regime did transform itself via elections in 1996.
Yes, they did have elections, but these elections were marred by a variety of irregularities. In fact, it is estimated that in 1996, that transitioned the country from military rule to civilian rule, the election had been rigged. It actually was won by Usainu Darboe, who was the main party leader for the UDP. And since then, elections have been held regularly, of course, but with a lot of repression. The opposition basically didn't have access to the media, and Jammeh really made it very difficult for them to compete on a level playing field.
In 1996, as I said, they formed a civilian party, which is called APRC, Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction. Patriotic reorientation really means keeping the population under a state of permanent mobilization, changing attitudes towards a number of issues. Then there was also the construction bit. The APRC regime embarked on a very ambitious developmental agenda. They knew that Gambians were craving for development, and that was one of the major grievances against the former regime. So they built schools and roads, the first university in the Gambia, a new airport, they brought electricity to many villages, and all that actually gave some support to the Jammeh administration, at least in the beginning. Things actually, however, changed very soon. It soon became clear that the Jammeh administration would rule not only by doing good policies, but also by intimidation and repression. And the Second Republic, his time, became known, in fact, as a harsh and very crude dictatorship.
Under Jammeh, there was improvement in the infrastructure. He built schools and hospitals, roads, but that ended in really putting the economy and the country in debt, severe debt. At the same time, the hospitals didn't have the trained doctors, the schools didn't have teachers. So while he might have done some infrastructural improvements, these were really wanting to some degree. Yes, some improvement was made, but it couldn't be kept up. Shortly thereafter, things began to deteriorate significantly.
Yeah, as I said, there's infrastructural development, but at the same time, it was very clear from the very beginning that Jammeh and some of his fellows, at least, were soldiers or were to remain soldiers, even in civilian clothes. And limitations to freedom of expression, as well as to political associations and opposition, were there from the very beginning. Until 2000, there was a certain sense that this was needed in order to oust the old dignitaries and politicians associated with the old regime. But then, when in 2000, during a student protest, the security forces opened fire on the demonstrators and killed 15 people and injured many others, the feeling that things were going to change was very palpable. The climate changed a lot even before that, but especially after this event. Since then, Jammeh has been ruling really with an iron fist, and he has collected an impressive record of human rights violations denounced by journalists and human rights organizations. These include arbitrary detentions and killings, torture, violence, and incommunicado disappearances.
And he had informants all over the country with the Secret Service that has agents everywhere, even in your house. You don't know if you say, express certain opinions, if your brother or your sister will go and report you to the Secret Service, and they can come anytime and then you will disappear. If you're lucky, you will show up in court. If you are not lucky, you will be arrested forever. And the third one is you will never be seen again.
Following his assumption of power through a military coup in 1994, Jammeh grew increasingly repressive. Human rights violations that were protected jealously under Saadawda began to deteriorate significantly. Journalists were the first to suffer. In the end, most of them got exiled. A major editor of a paper was assassinated, allegedly by his squads. So over a period of 5 years, things that never happened in Gambia before, killings, extrajudicial killings, torture, arrests, you name it, disappearances, began to mount. By the time he had been there in 10, 15 years, the human rights record was horrendous and reported consistently on by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and regional organizations, to the degree that really his time in power saw a deterioration of human rights that was unequaled in the history of the country.
I'm just wondering what impact that had, especially on young people in Gambia, Gambia, and whether or not you saw people actually leaving and wanting to go somewhere else.
Yes. In addition to those who had fled the country initially when he took power, in the last years of his stay in power, many young people took what they called the back way. Economic conditions became so poor, so bad, so horrendous, that many were pushed out of the country, of course, on their own voluntarily. They ended up either traveling through the Sahara under very difficult conditions, many of them perishing, or taking rickety boats from Libya in their efforts to get into Europe.
The Gambia sends more people, or more Gambians migrate to Europe over the Mediterranean than any other country. The Gambia is, you know, it's not a war-torn country. Dueling that, you can do basically two things. You have the sort of economy, the fact that unemployment is high. You go to Gambian villages and there's like no jobs. Everybody's unemployed. If you are, especially if you're a young man, the social pressure on you to sort of be a provider for the family is really significant. And in that situation, you may feel like you don't have a choice other than to kind of risk this really quite dangerous trip to Europe. And of course, it's not just an economic story. It's also compounded by the politics of the Gambia, the fact that the Jammeh government was erratic, took decisions that probably were not advantageous to economic growth. It was corrupt. You know, if you were part of his inner circle, you could benefit. If you were not, you would not benefit. So it was not simply a kind of straightforward economics malaise that the country had, but it was one that was compounded by political mismanagement and oppression as well.
We begin with breaking news out of Gambia. The Electoral Commission there has confirmed that opposition candidate Adama Barrow has won the presidential election, bringing an end to current President Yahya Jammeh's 22-year rule.
The electoral result came as a surprise. That was on December 1st, 2016. Adama Barrow won with slightly more than 43% of the vote. Now, it came as a surprise to many international observers, but by that time it wasn't really a surprise to many Gambians who had lived a moment. The reasons for this kind of radical change in attitudes is certainly, and most importantly perhaps, that Gambians were really fed up. Simply fed up with Jammeh's abuses of power and also human rights violations. The electoral result was greeted widely as a return to freedom. Freedom was really a key word during the campaign and afterwards.
It was a combination of factors. And I think the first and perhaps most important is the fact that the opposition political parties, in spite of having tried in previous elections to come together as one, finally were able to do so. And then, of course, the diaspora became increasingly critical of Jammeh. And they were able to raise monies that had never been raised before, something to the tune of $150,000 American. And he was shocked. He didn't believe that he could lose the election.
President Jammeh initially conceded defeat to Barrow, but dramatically reversed course and rejected the election results.
I wasn't shocked that he lost power. I was shocked that he accepted. I've been covering the election for years. I was shocked that he agreed that he lost the election and accepted the outcome of the election. That was before he changed his mind. So that's what shocked me. But him losing the election didn't really shock me because people had just enough of him and people wanted change.
President Yahya Jammeh's ruling party challenged his December 1st election defeat at the Supreme Court Wednesday as a group of...
The regional organization, the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, they took a very firm line. And they were basically spearheaded by Nigeria and Senegal. And they said, we don't recognize your attempts to basically alter the outcome of the election. We consider that you lost and you need to step down. That was basically the ECOWAS position. And what's significant here is that there was ECOWAS kind of spoke with one voice. There really were no regional countries that were kind of in favor of Jammeh at this point. Sometimes in West African politics, you see a split between the Anglophone and the Francophone countries. And you saw that in the 1990s, for example, that the Anglophone and the Francophone countries had slightly different priorities. This was not the case here. There was no daylight between the position of Senegal and Nigeria. And those are, especially for the Gambia, the most important countries in West Africa. You know, when they basically said, you got to go, and we are ready to use military force to enforce that, it was pretty much over for Jammeh. I think at that time, the question did not become, is Jammeh going to leave? The question is, how is he going to leave? And is there going to be violence? And now, thankfully, we know that he, in the end, left without any violence or note.
And I am hopeful. We are all hopeful. But one thing I am sure, the Gambians have decided that they will no longer be standbys when it comes to issues affecting their country. And I'm really glad that finally people have come to realize that this is their country and they have to stay in every aspect of how it's run. And the people have now realized that the power is with them. The power is not with the government or the president. The people are the one who gave that power to the government. So that's a good thing.
What Gambia has done is really to show the global system that, in fact, it is possible through democratic means to dislodge a brutal dictator. And I think it also sends a very strong lesson to dictators throughout the continent and possibly other places that the international community would come to their rescue if they held free and fair elections and dislodged such dictators. So this is a very singularly loud cry message to dictators like, if I may call out some names, Robert Mugabe, the president of Sudan. There will come a time when individuals and populations, following years of repression, will rise up. And they can do that peacefully without a drop of blood being shed.
Abdoulaye Sen, professor of global economy and politics at Miami University. My other guests, journalist and activist Aisha Dabu, Nicholas Holton, Assistant Professor of Global Affairs at George Mason University, and Paolo Gaibazzi, Anthropologist and Research Fellow at the ZMO in Berlin. And if you've enjoyed this program, send us an email or write us a review on your podcasting app so other listeners can also find us. The sound engineer is Simon Braithwaite. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on RN.